home and he paid me home.
Yeah, she said that she before the program, Ron introduced me to my new microphone. Yay! Yeah, pretty, right? And I think it might be from outer space. At any rate, and he asked me if I wanted to wear it, but I think I'm just going to set it right here. I think it'll behave. So I want to start by thanking all of the members and friends of the Karma Teksum Choling of beautiful downtown Columbus, Ohio, for being here this evening. And thank also the folks at Thurber Center for being great hosts to us. Also want to say a few words of thanks to all of the people who attended here earlier today and who showed up early to create a sacred environment, hauling all of these cushions in their cars and then setting them out so that they are neat and useful and beautiful. And also thank all the people who came and did the registration, who did the online work and the publicity and so forth and so on. There is so much that goes into one of these programs that is unseen. It's behind the scenes. And I want to thank everybody who had anything to do with putting this together. So thank you for that. It's said that even building a temporary structure for Dharma teaching to occur in is highly meritorious, meaning that it generates virtue in the mind. It generates a feeling of virtue and happiness in the mind to create even just a temporary location for the Dharma. And this goes back to a story from the life of the Buddha where one of the kings of the city-state of a city-state in northern India created a mud brick temple for the Buddha to give a teaching inside. And then during the rainy season, that mud brick temple washed away. And someone said to the king, "Wow, what a waste of your money creating this place that only lasted for a season before the rains washed it away." And the Buddha replied, hearing this criticism, the Buddha replied, "Oh no, you don't understand. The virtue that was created from that temporary mud brick temple is still existing and will exist till the end of time." And so the idea here is that when we generate a virtuous mind state, when we generate a virtuous mind, that virtuous mind that we generate bears fruit for us immediately as I guess you could say a state of happiness, and then bears fruit for us in the future as well. And we'll learn more about that during this weekend that we're going to spend time together. As we spend time together this weekend, we're going to learn a little bit about what the virtuous mind is, how we generate it, and how it will help us in our everyday life, as well as in, you could say, our, let's use the word cosmic, our spiritual life. And so we'll talk about that this weekend. So the virtue that's been generated by the people who created this environment will go on and on. And also the virtue that you created in your mind by wanting to be here. Even if there was something you were thinking of doing this evening and then this arrived on the scene. So your mind is maybe even a little divided, like, oh, maybe I should have done this with my family, or maybe I should have done this with my coworkers, or maybe I should. Regardless of all of those, you are here. And I really appreciate your taking the time out for yourself. Because in a way, coming to a program like this is a gift that you give to yourself. It's a gift that you give to yourself because every minute that you are here, either learning meditation or practicing meditation, is a minute you are not trying to bear the weight of the world on your shoulders, a minute that you are not trying to solve problems at work, a minute that you're not trying to solve problems at home, and so forth. So in a way, you've given yourself a bit of rest
a bit of rest. That you can, if you're keeping a self-care checklist, you do get to check this off in the self-care checklist because you're doing yourself a favor by learning about meditation and practicing meditation. So we're in good shape. So at any rate, I want to start by saying a few things about what we're going to be talking about this weekend. I'm going to outline the weekend for you a bit. And then we're going to do a tiny, tiny bit of meditation and then talk about the mind that meditates, and a little bit about how that works. So we'll start with a moment of quiet reflection. I'd like for you to take a moment and reflect on your gratitude for being in this environment that we've created this evening. And to just take a moment to relax your mind into a feeling of aspiration, aspiring that this evening and any time you can spend this weekend, that this time you spend will be for the benefit of sentient beings. We'll sit quietly for a moment of reflection. I'll begin with a short prayer. If it's going to be the four-line refuge prayer in Tibetan that's at the beginning of the Chenrezig practice. If this is a prayer with which you're familiar, you can join in. But if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, don't worry. You can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session and all the time we spend together this weekend to the benefit of all beings who suffer. I'll recite it just one time. O Sanje Chudan Sochi Chonam La Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Da ji jin so ji be su nam ki dro la pen shi san je tru pa sho o pa den sa we la ma rin bo che ta gi chi or pe de ten shi la Adren Jembo Poneche Sante Pusum Tugging a Drup Saltusong. Okay, thank you. Before I begin, there's one comment I'd like to make, and that is that it delights me that the Columbus KTC requests these teaching weekends from me yearly. Last weekend, I was in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, the weekend before last, I was in Erie, Pennsylvania, teaching at the Dharma Center there. And it tickles me to think that that I get an opportunity to share some Dharma in depth, not just in places where Kempo Rinpoche asked me to go. When I got out of a three-year retreat, he said, help at the Columbus KTC and then travel and teach. And so I've been doing that now for 20 years. And so it's a delight to me to be able to share some of the programming that I share with the Dharma centers around the country. I get to share it here as well. So I'm just tickled and happy you're here. So anyway, I was thinking about that. I walked into a really interesting environment there. In Erie, they have their Dharma meetings in an old Catholic grade school. So you go in, and it's still run by the nuns. So you go in, yeah, but these are cool nuns. These are super cool nuns. My program was in an old classroom that was decorated as a writing room for writing seminars to be held in. And so there were all these beautiful icons, hand-painted in the style of our friend Paul Volcker, not by him, but in his illustrative style, all over the walls, inspiring quotes from various saints and great teachers, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So it was a very uplifted space. So it's delightful to come and share here as well. So a little bit about what we're doing this weekend. I'm sure everyone here has done some meditation. And if you've done some meditation, you know that it can sometimes be a bit of a challenge. And what makes meditation sometimes a challenge is our own tendency to think that other things are more important. Now, maybe this isn't you, but this is me. We have so many things and responsibilities in our lives that it's so hard to fit meditation in. So one of the things I'm hoping this weekend will do for us is give us a new push to want to do meditation when we see the value of it in our everyday life. So that's the first thing. The other challenge that we have when we meditate is being able to follow the technique of meditation. And so I'm hoping that this weekend, in between the sessions of discussion about the wheel of life and the 12 links of interdependence, in between, we'll get a little bit of meditation done. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have about meditation. We'll do short 2 to 5 minute sessions of meditation sprinkled throughout the program, and then anybody who has meditation questions, we can answer those. The reason that I wanted to sprinkle some meditation throughout the session was if all I do is give you information, it may not all go in. Some of it may, this happens to me, if I get too much, it kind of like, it's like water on the ground. Sometimes it goes in and sometimes it kind of just goes over the surface and then rolls down to the gutter and wanders off. So it's my hope to be able to share information in such a way and intersperse it with some meditation so that it can percolate in a little bit. So that's a little bit about the format for the weekend. So before I start, I want to see how many folks here have heard about the Wheel of Life before. How many? So we've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. Okay, we've got about 12 people who've heard of it before. Okay, good. So what I'll do is I'll start this evening by introducing what it is and give everybody an idea of how it is a pictorial illustration of the path to awakening. As was noted when Kim read the introduction, we all want to have a happier life. And it seems that that is really the goal for so many people. They even wrote it into our United States Declaration of Independence, right? The pursuit of happiness. And so if happiness is so important to human beings, then you would think that learning how to be happy would be a subject everywhere. Unfortunately, we don't seem to see too much about it in our everyday educational system. How to be happy courses usually are things that you learn on the weekends. So what we have to do is we have to find out what is the definition of happiness. What do people think of as happiness? Some people think it's being physically comfortable. Some folks think that happiness is being financially comfortable. Some people think that happiness is having friends and family surrounding one. Other people think that happiness is being beautifully alone. And And there are still other people who think that happiness is something that can be obtained, can be acquired. And they spend a lot of their time acquiring what they think will bring happiness. Since we haven't had too many courses on the true causes of happiness in school, we do tend to learn a little bit from field study. We go here, we go there, we go to the amusement park, we go to the library, we go to the supermarket, we go to the shopping mall, we go skydiving, we go to the roller coaster, we go everywhere seeking experiences that will bring what we think happiness is. And so I guess you could say that we spend the majority of our day seeking happiness. I was recently going on a travel to a different Dharma center, and I got on an airplane, and I had this sudden moment of revelation. Every single person was seeking happiness on that airplane. Because you could see it. One person was trying to jealously guard their seat and make sure that no one was crossing over their armrest so they could have their perfect seat. Other people were looking to find out, to sit in exactly the right seat to be served their drinks and snacks first. Other people were looking to have quiet by putting on their headphones and not engaging with anyone. Other people were seeking happiness by unwrapping their lunch. Other people were seeking happiness by putting that lovely little pillow around their neck so they could take a nap. So everybody on that airplane was seeking some kind of comfort and happiness. And it reminded me of something Kempo Carter Rinpoche said so many years ago when he was teaching here. He said, when you look at the world, you see people, animals, even insects scuttling to and fro, continuously in motion, always in motion. And he said, and what are they doing? They're all seeking to be happy. And that's their mission. You know, as the turtle moves, the turtle is seeking happiness. As the bird is flying, the bird is seeking happiness. And so as a result of this, we're very busy. We're very busy. But really what's interesting is that happiness does not necessarily come from our external environment. It doesn't necessarily come from what we acquire or what we own. It doesn't even come from experiences that we have, the experience of love and family and so forth. Even all of these things are not the cause of happiness. The cause of happiness is something that is deeper within the individual. It comes from within. If we look at the teachings of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, this is what he was getting at in these words that were the first words of his book of sayings, the Dhammapada. He says, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts, we make the world. And so what he means by this is that happiness arises with our thoughts. Suffering arises with our thoughts. So how we think about things determines how we feel about them. And how we think and feel determines our experience of those things. And so this teaching shows, from the Buddhist point of view, or from the Buddhist point of view, that the cause of happiness is within us. It actually resides continuously like a flame within us at all times. Happiness and its causes rest within us. When the Buddha taught his Four Noble Truths, he talked mainly about suffering. He said suffering is part of life. That's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is that suffering has a cause, which he called clinging and fixation. And because suffering has a cause, it also has a solution, which is letting go of clinging and fixation. And finally, there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. And that's the path of not harming, benefiting, and taming the mind. And so the Buddha gave a complete view about the mind and how it creates its reality, and how through grasping and fixation it creates suffering, and how through letting go it creates happiness. So you could say that the teachings of the Buddha are quite simple. They're actually quite simple. They're not all that complicated, although if you go to the library and see how many Buddhist books there are, you might think that the Buddhist teaching would be rather complicated. It does all come down to the mind and how we work with our mind, because our mind is what determines our experience. Two people can go to a beautiful park on a sunny day and have two completely different experiences. One person can go to that park and think of everything as being beautiful, and think about the breeze, and think about the trees, and think about the flowers and the insects. Other people will go to the same park and come away saying, it was so windy, it was so hot, it was so awful. There were all of these trees and there was so much pollen. And you know, there were insects everywhere. And so they had no fun whatsoever, because their ideas about what fun is, their idea about what fun is completely different than another person's. So two people can have exactly the same experience but come away with two completely different ideas. And that's determined by the mind. That's not determined by the body. That's determined by the mind. Our skin, which feels temperature, does not think. The skin doesn't think. The ears, they convey the sounds, but the ears don't think. The eyes that see things don't think. The nose that smells things, the nose doesn't think. The tongue that tastes things, it doesn't think. It's the mind that receives this input, and the mind thinks. And it's the mind that it takes these experiences and turns them into ideas, and turns them into little stories that we tell ourselves about what's going on. What's interesting about these stories is that, I guess you could say, we're all storytellers. We're all storytellers. I mean, we love fiction, right? We love to watch television programs. The more complicated, the better. We read mysteries. We see films. We go to shows. We do all of these things and follow and pursue fiction because we love stories. And I think this is a reflection of the stories we tell ourselves about our experience in the world. You could say we are the main character in our own drama. And all of the other people are also thinking they are the main character in their drama. And so, of course, this means that conflict will arise when our story and their story come together but somehow do not mesh. Our narratives do not mesh. I think that when they said that to me, they meant this. And they think that when they said that to me, they meant that. And so on. It starts with misunderstanding and then can actually, shall we say, explode into controversy and conflict. Even simple things can become complicated. And so what this tells us is that if we want to work with our experience, we have to work with our mind. We have to learn how to work with our mind, which is the author of our experience. So that means that meditation is an important part of our learning how to be happy. Remember, from the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha said that clinging and fixation causes suffering. And so letting go is a cause of happiness. Learning how to let go is the whole path of Buddhism. Because if somebody is suffering, you can't just look at them and say, oh, just let that go. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. We actually have to help them understand how they can let go, not just say, oh, let that go. It's not fair. It's not fair. It's not taking their feelings into consideration. So now we have to learn the how of letting go. And this is where meditation comes in and why the program this weekend is going to start with a little meditation. I'm going to talk a little bit about the practice of quiet sitting meditation, which is called shamatha in Sanskrit and shine in Tibetan. But it means calm abiding. And this calm abiding meditation is how we learn how to work with our minds. We learn our minds through the practice of meditation. So let's do a little meditation. Meditation starts with working with the body and putting the body in a position of relative ease. One of my meditation teachers taught about meditation. He said the technique can be taught in two phrases: body at ease, mind at ease. And so what this means is that we put our body in a relatively more comfortable position. We'll just say relatively, because your mileage may vary. We put our body into a relatively comfortable position, and then we place our attention. Putting our mind at ease consists of placing our attention on an object and then gently returning our attention to that object when it wanders. So let's start with the body. The posture of meditation, if you're sitting in a chair, is to place your feet flat on the floor with the hips, the knees, and the ankles in that nice little 90-degree angle that where the feet touch the floor. They're about hip-width apart, about the distance of your hips apart, flat on the floor. If you can't place your feet flat on the floor, we have little cushions here that you can use to put under your feet to help them be flat. So that's the feet. Now, if you're sitting on the floor, you can cross your legs in any one of the many ways of crossing the legs. One leg in front of the other, one on top of the other, and so forth, or just lightly crossed in front of you. The key piece is to have your knees lower than your hips or at the same level as your hips. The problems come in posture when your hips are way up above your your knees are way up above your hips because it puts too much pressure on the joint. So that's the lower part of your body, the legs and the feet. Now, the seat. You ground yourself on your seat. Kemp Rinpoche taught this little grounding exercise. He said, grounding yourself on your seat, you rock gently from side to side and tuck in the muscles of your behind. Just tuck them in. And that grounds you on your seat. Your back has its nice, gentle curves in it. And you can place your hands palm downward on your legs to help steady you. Your shoulders can be straight. The chin can be tucked in slightly. And the gaze, you can either gaze generally at the area a few feet ahead of you. And again, you're gazing generally. You're not looking. You're just gazing. Or you can close your eyes, but I have to warn you, if you close your eyes, you might be tempted to fall asleep. So see what works best for you. Finally, the tip of the tongue can be touched to the upper palate behind the front teeth. This relaxes the muscles of the face. So that's putting the body at ease. The legs, the seat, the back, the shoulders, hands and arms, the chin, the gaze, and the tip of the tongue. When Kempo Kartha Rinpoche teaches meditation, he says, first place your body in the posture of meditation and just let it sit there for a moment. Placing the mind at ease consists of using the technique of placing your attention on the breath. And you do this by taking one deep breath. And then breathe out. And then allow your breath to come and go naturally, placing your attention on the breath as it comes in and goes out. The technique of working with your attention is, one lama called this technique touch and let go. When you place your attention on the breath as it comes in and goes out, it'll stay there for a short period of time, but then your attention might wander into something that happened before, or something that's going to happen tomorrow, or something that's happening now. And the instruction is, when you notice that your attention has wandered off the breath, you stop a moment, you note that you are thinking, and then you release the thought, return your attention to the breath for a fresh start. And that's the technique of touch and let go. So using these two techniques, watching the breath, and that practice of touching and letting go to return your attention, we'll practice meditation for about 2 or 3 minutes. It's a very short meditation. How was it? Easy, difficult, thoughts? What do you think? What's that? Practice, okay, yeah. Anybody have questions about the technique or how it worked out for you? Things go right, things go wrong? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a couple suggestions. The first thing is, I think the first part might be a little physical. It could be that you have longer legs, and if you have longer legs, then you might benefit from using a higher cushion, because the cushion you're on right now is kind of low, and it does put it does make your knees go up above your hips. So we might try one of the taller cushions for you. That would be the first thing I'd suggest, is that you try a taller cushion. Then the second thing is, if the taller cushion doesn't help, they actually make something really neat, and it's a kneeling bench. It's made out of wood, and they use it in Zen temples. I think it works really well for people with longer legs, because then they can actually put their bottoms on the kneeling bench, and then their feet can go underneath, and they'll have less pain in their legs. So I would try those two things. And Rinpoche told me one time, he said, you can actually use your discomfort a little bit in meditation. At first, when you feel uncomfortable, you like want to move immediately. And he said, don't move immediately. He said, be disciplined and stable. And he said, so tell yourself, I don't think I need to move just yet. Don't, you know, that way you don't squirm immediately. And then he said, when it comes back the second time and it says, excuse me, you're hurting, then you can move. That way you stretch your thinking a little farther. Does that make sense? But I would try one or both of those things. I have a kneeling bench at home, and I really like it. It helps me a lot. So, okay. All right. Yeah. Taller cushion. Want to hand the taller cushion that direction? Yeah, let's get you on a taller cushion. That might help. Yeah, but some of it is not being used to it. I agree. It took me a long time to get used to it. So even that may not work. So we'll see, right? But you do have longer legs, and so yeah. See, right now it's even worse. So I think you might have to cross your. There you go. And then put little cushions underneath your knees. You know, so. That I try that first, and if that doesn't help, then I get the kneeling bench, I think of. Okay. Okay. Yeah, you can also kneel on. Let's see, is that one got kapok in it? The one in front, the one in the front. You can also like kneel on that. I mean, not kneel on it, but put it, like, get into a kneeling position and then put it between your. Yeah, kind of like that. Only, the other way. Yeah, like long ways, because that's sideways. Yeah, like that. Not that way. The other way. Nope. Put it on its end, so that the handle's up. That's it. Yeah, does it? Oh, yeah, because he's not so tall. Yeah, you're right. Okay, you're right. It does look like it works better the other way. Good thinking. All right, try that and just see what that does. What the heck, right? Worth a try. Other things people would like to say about meditation? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. See, no, it's actually not silly. You know what it shows? It shows, you know what's interesting about this, and I'm really glad you asked this question, because I think what it is, there's two things going on in this question, and they're both good. I mean, it's like good thinking. You know what I mean? It's like you're analyzing the situation. The first is that thoughts start as these tiny little, I almost want to call them an inkling. You know, there's just like this little tension that happens when a thought arises, and it's very small. And you're right. It can be like the little germination of a weed in your yard. It starts as just a little thing, and then all of the habit energy that's related with that thought. Like, when I think this, I get like this, or when I think this, I get like this, you know. And so then it becomes like a weed that grows after a rainfall. So feeling it come close to you, feeling that thought arising, you have two choices. You could look at it, or you could look away and go back to the breath immediately. You don't even have to touch it, if you know what I'm saying. If it's small enough, if it's subtle enough that you're aware of it's there, then just look away from it. When I say look away, I don't mean with your eyes. Turn your attention away from it and go back to the breath immediately without the step of labeling it. And that might actually work. Because what happens is, at first, our thoughts are so large to us. They're memories of things that happened before, or they're anticipations of things that may happen tomorrow. And so they're stories. They're sort of full-blown stories. Some thoughts are like full-blown stories, but others are just little inklings that haven't quite caught on yet. But they're sitting there at the edge of our awareness, wanting to say, "Oh, come and play. You really don't want to meditate. You want to do me instead. Really, you know you do, you know." And that's kind of what happens to us. One Lama said once, "It's difficult to meditate because we think that thinking is important." Really? Okay. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. Well, I do. Yeah. Uh-huh. No, but it's all related to meditation, because these are the little things that can distract us and defeat us and make us feel frustrated. And one of the things I like to help people with is the little things that frustrate them when they try to meditate. Because you wouldn't believe how many people have experienced exactly what you're talking about, and that they've used that as a reason to just give up meditating. Well, like, I can't get beyond this, or I can't get beyond that. But they actually can. They can actually make progress, even with difficult thoughts that come up again and again. There's, you know, I know a gentleman who struggles with a type of intrusive thought disorder. And what's really interesting is that he says, I'm determined to beat this thing, because I know that these thoughts are meaningless, and that it's just a habit that I feel I have to have them. And he says, but it doesn't mean it's not easy. You know, it doesn't mean it's easy. He says, it's hard sometimes. But he says, but there's, from his point of view, there's nothing more worthwhile than to try to work with these tendencies. And I think that this is the other half. Remember, I said there were two things about your question that's good. One shows that thoughts are subtle, and then the other one shows that we care. Because we care about meditation. We also care about these things, you know, that we've been thinking about. So, but what we have to figure out is how much care is necessary and what care we can just let go of. We can care about the techniques of meditation, but we don't need to over-apply them. Which is why I'm saying you can merely try looking away from the thought and going back to the breath, not even labeling it, just making the shift, because that's a choice and you can make that. And there's no need to sort of heavy-handedly apply it, trying to figure out what kind of thought it is, or is it big enough to mess with. the idea is that once it arises in your field of understanding, your field of awareness, then just turn your attention back to the breath. So we have to learn how to apply our remedies gently and effectively. And it's the same with these thoughts. And we do care about the things that arise for us. Sometimes we think about our family. Sometimes we think about work. Sometimes we have a great idea for the great American novel. Anything can happen when your mind starts relaxing. And so what Kemper Rinpoche said you can do with these is you can actually use this noting function, you know, I'm having a thought, and make an aspiration, I will think about this later, and then go back to the technique of watching the breath. If you feel that feeling of caring maybe too much about this thought, but you see what I'm saying? Or if you have, Rinpoche says, if you have a brilliant idea and you're a writer, like, you know, that you want to write down the idea, he said, don't do that. It'll break your meditation. So instead, he said, just make a mental note. I will think about that later, or I will remember this when the meditation is over. Sometimes you will, and sometimes you won't. But you will have given it the due, you know, you will give it its due, but you'll also be able to return. And you know that there are only a few subjects about which you will say that. Most of them will be like passing things that you won't need to care about. Okay? Yeah. Okay, yes, uh-huh.
If the thought that's coming to you while you're meditating is something that is naturally an anxiety-related thought, would it be easier or would it be more helpful to kind of let that thought overcome you, if you will, for the future when you're not meditating and that thought just comes to you in everyday life and you're not meditating?
When you say think it through, see, I want to make sure I understand. And this also occurred to me with Justin's question, because that is a possibility. If you feel an anxious thought, let's say you have an anxious thought about something that makes you feel anxious, then if so are you saying you want to just think that thought all the way through, or let, when you say let it overcome you, what does that look like?
Do you acknowledge it? That you would break the meditative state, I think, a little, but do you kind of acknowledge it and kind of feel it in that meditative state? Would it be helpful?
If it doesn't lead you into a story. If it doesn't lead you into a story and it allows you to move your attention back to the breath, then I would say your chances are better your chances are better here's the thing. Both techniques have merit. Both techniques have merit. Because my friends in psychotherapy say that a lot of depression and anxiety comes from paying attention in the wrong way to the wrong thoughts, or the right thoughts in the wrong way, but you get, you know. And it's paying too much attention to something and not being able to shift your attention. You see, with that idea in mind, then being able to shift away back to the breath will allow you to have felt that for a moment. So you've got the feeling. You're not pushing it down into a box. You're going, okay, there's that. But then you're saying, but this is what I'm paying attention to. Yes, there's that, but here's what I'm paying attention to, my breath. Okay? Even when you're not meditating, and this doesn't happen instantly, but it happens my own counselor and I have discussed this before, and her feeling is that over time, it allows us to let go of things as they are happening to us when we're not meditating. But we can't expect that that's going to happen right away the first time we meditate. It could be weeks or months or even years before that kind of effect would happen when we're not meditating. So that's one way of handling it, is to merely turn your attention. The other way would be to look into it, to not to tell yourself a story of it, about it, but to look deeply into the thought itself, and it may actually fall apart if you look at it, if you don't allow a story about it to spin. But see, if the story starts to spin, then it's captured you, and then having followed it will not have been useful. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And this is why I love talking to people about meditation, because there are all of these really amazing, interesting little things that we find out as we work with our mind. There's time for one more. Is there anybody else who have something else? Let me see if there's a person who hasn't asked a question yet, okay, and then I'll come back. Anybody who hasn't asked a question yet like to say something or ask? Okay, sure.
When I'm
You mean adding words to it? Well, yes, I completely agree with that. You know, I completely agree with that, because I really am glad that you said that, because that was a key for me to understand what your question is. I think you're onto something here, and that is that meditation is not making your mind have no thoughts. You know, it's not pressing down on your mind so there's no thoughts in it. It's actually placing your attention on something and leaving it there for as long as it naturally will rest, which will really only be a few seconds, and then it'll start to go off, because we're used to being entertained like all the time, right? I mean, even people like me who are meditators give into the cell phone and look at our tablets and look at our computers and things like that. And so I think that being able to return your attention to your breath is the important thing. Don't worry about the same thought coming back too many times, as long as you can just go back to the breath. But yes, if you want to try thinking your way through the breath is coming in, the breath is going out, you could, and then you could even count it, in breath, out breath, one. In breath, out breath, two. And some people will even use their beads, if you've got beads. In breath, out breath, move your bead. In breath, out breath, move a bead, and so forth, like that. We have that. So those types of things will also help. So try those and see how they work. Okay. Yeah, so thanks for letting me take you on a little journey about meditation. I appreciate that. Because the reason I brought up meditation this early in the program is because it goes back to that statement by the Buddha, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. And then in the next line he says, if we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, suffering follows us, just as surely does the wheel follow the ox that draws the cart. And if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows us, like a shadow that can't be shaken. And so what he's getting at here then is that the choice to be happy or to be unhappy arises with how we respond to what arises in our minds. how we respond to those things, what our habits are. Now, of course, the person who hears that statement may want to say, well, what's the impure mind and what's the pure mind? Well, what it is the selfish mind is the impure mind, the mind that is only concerned with it, with its own pleasure and comfort and so forth. The selfish mind is always grasping at things and trying to acquire things and people and experiences, thinking that by acquiring things, one will be happy. The unselfish mind is the pure mind, the mind that is able to let go, the mind that's able let others have happiness and so forth, and that thinks about the happiness of others. And so this is why the Buddha said, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. And with the practice of meditation, we begin to know what's on our mind. We can actually see individual thoughts. Whereas before, all we could see were the stories, the bigger stories. Then slowly, as we meditate, and those stories get shortened to just that thought or just that thought. And we find that we can let that thought and that thought go. When we can let that thought go, then the world that was created by that thought can also go. It can also disappear. It can also change. And if we can do that, then that means we can change any habit that we have. Any habit that we have, any negative habit that we've ever had, is just made of this habit energy that comes from our continuous way of thinking about how we think about things. And if we can let go of one thought and return to the breath, if we can let go of even just one thought, that means that every habit theoretically can potentially be changed. And so we can begin to learn how to let go of some things that used to bother us. Some of the people I know who, when they first start meditating, have a lot of things on their mind, that slowly over time they say, well, you know, stuff that used to bother me a lot doesn't bother me as much anymore. And it's because we learned how to let go in that moment when that thought arose and said, me, me, pay attention to me. If we let go of that thought in that moment, there was some power that came to us. An empowerment came to us to let go of that. And that is encouragement for people who want to learn how to change habits. And so, but that's not all we can understand about the mind. We can understand even more about the mind if we learn about the patterns that we have. When the one question came in about thinking the same thing over and over again, this question is, a lot of people have it because they do tend to think the same things over and over again. And how we handle those thoughts when they arise is going to be a big determiner of our peace of mind, sanity, stability, and goodness. So that's what the function of this weekend's discussion is, because where our thoughts go and what they, what types of emotion predominates in those thoughts is going to determine how we experience the world. That's the whole wheel of life. You've seen pictures of it. And each picture shows and denotes one type of negative mental affliction and the world that we create for ourselves with that negative mental affliction. The world that's created by anger, the world that's created by jealousy, the world that's created by chosen ignorance, the world that's chosen by stinginess and greed, the world that's chosen by attachment, and the world that is, I think I left one out. Which one did I leave out? Jealousy, anger, stinginess. Oh, and just everyday attachment. what we might call the everyday obsession. So these six states are depicted in a picture that talk about how we create our external experience. It's not that we create the things that happen to us exactly, but what we do create is how we view those things that happen to us. Let me give you an example. On my way here, I received a phone call from a Dharma student in a distant city whose husband just found out that he has a serious form of cancer. She was in the hospital room with him. They had just gotten the news 20 minutes before. And it's really interesting. And I talked to her about how she was feeling, what her feelings were in that moment. And she says, it's a shock. I'm kind of overcome. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to feel, but I'm afraid. I don't want him to have a lot of pain and suffering. And then she came into, this was, she was in the hallway, pardon me, when she called me. Then she went into the room and she handed the phone to her husband. First thing he said was, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisoha, which is a mantra from a Buddhist sutra, the Heart Sutra. And it means gone, gone, gone beyond, beyond the beyond, hail the one who goes. And basically, it's a testament to the emptiness of all phenomena. And so that's the first thing he says to me. And so he's trying to be brave for her, but he might be scared too. But it's really interesting that that's what he chose to say and where he chose to place his mind in that moment. And so it seems to me that there's a journey for both of them in this, and for all of us as we go through our lives. There's a journey for all of us. But what we choose, how we choose to experience that moment, at first may not be a choice. It may be our habit, just as we were saying, just kind of rolls us over, you know. We just have to have that thought. We have to think that thought. And it just pushes us over. But over time, it may slowly not push us over, at least not so fast. And then we can begin to see that thought, feeling, and emotion differently. And so what this weekend is about the world we create with our thoughts. What kind of world is that? And what did the Buddha say about this world? And so I'm conscious of the time. I'm going to say maybe one or two more things and then we'll do some questions. The Buddha taught that each of us has a mind. Each of us has an individual mind. We're actually separate from others. I know some great philosophers in the West liked to come up with the idea that we're all part of one big mind somewhere. But this was not the teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha said we're all actually individuals and that we are in this world together and we're aware of one another, but we're not all part of one big mind. The proof of this, the Buddha said, was the Buddha himself. He said, if we were all part of one big mind, then when the Buddha became awakened, all of us would have become awakened. But it didn't work like that. So each of us has our own separate mind that is working with and experiencing this world. And he said, not only do we have our own individual minds, our own individual minds have the potential to know themselves. Our mind has the potential to know itself. we can know physical objects. We can know and understand and feel and experience external objects. And so this is a great skill. It's kept our species alive for quite a long time. It's very useful. But it's not the only thing our mind can know. Our mind can actually know and experience itself. And in knowing and experiencing itself, it can become liberated. Well, what does liberation mean? Well, right now, we tend to think of liberation as being unending happiness, that we have to somehow acquire, bless you, that we somehow have to acquire. We have to acquire this happiness by getting things and experiences and people and having them all set up just nicely. I've seen in the news lately some people make fun of a certain prominent political person. And they make fun of him because he places everything just so on his desk before he undertakes a meeting. But guess what? We all do that. You should see me. I'm kind of awful. It's because there's a certain order that we feel comfortable with. And when that order is not there, we feel uncomfortable. But so in a way, you could say that even these things that we think will bring us happiness are actually putting us in a form of bondage. We're bound to these preferences. I want it to be just right. Everything has to match. Everything has to be just so. And in a way, we're sort of enslaved to our preferences. So you could say we're really not free at all. The truly free person would be a person who could just sit and be with whatever happened. The truly free person could just sit and see disorder in front of them, and this is not quite in the right place, and this is not quite in the right place. A truly liberated person would be liberated from all of these preferences and would be happy anywhere, under any circumstance, except, of course, if this is moved. So I'm just having fun. But a truly happy person would be liberated from preferences. And a truly liberated person would deeply care about everyone who was not liberated from their preferences. It's really hard for us to care about other people because there's so many reasons to dislike them. Oh, I don't like the way that person looks. Oh, I don't like the way that person talks. Oh, that person is so vacuous. Oh, that person is so this or so that. We have so many things that we dislike. Oh, this person doesn't believe things the way I believe them. Blah, blah, blah. There's so many things we can dislike. We're always picking things apart. And in picking things apart continuously, we're setting the level at which we will be unhappy. I will be unhappy if I have to sit next to that person. I will be unhappy if I have to engage with that person. We're always dividing the world and dividing and dividing and dividing and making ourselves really unhappy. And so how would it be to find a way to liberate ourselves from self-inflicted unhappiness? How cool would that be if we could find a way to relax and be with things that happen? Now, this doesn't mean that we will somehow suddenly stop fighting for justice in the world. It's not like that. But what we will gain from being able to let go is a feeling of caring, a deep caring for every person. Because when we see how we suffer, when we see how we cause our own suffering by the things we cling to, when we see how we cause our own unhappiness by wanting and wanting and wanting and wanting and gathering and gathering and gathering and pushing people over to get what we want, if we see how we make ourselves unhappy, then it's going to be pretty easy to see how other people make themselves unhappy. And sometimes that will give birth to some caring, really deep caring, and some empathy within us for other people. Because that empathy for other people, caring about them, is a way to shed our arrogance, to shed our feeling of superiority, like I'm smarter than that person, I'm better than that person, and so forth. Because it's that self-centered thinking that the Buddha said was the cause of our unhappiness. So in a way, you could say that the Buddha is doing us a favor, having examined his own mind and come to a state of liberation. He's now showing us how to do the same thing. He's showing us how to slowly let go of thoughts, slowly let go of preferences, and slowly inculcate a sense of unity, a sense of kinship with others that could maybe make us happier. So anyway, that's a lot of, as the Tibetans would say, that's a lot of yak, yak. I have never been liberated from being a punster. Somebody asked me the other day, you know, where did you get that sense of humor? And I said, from my dad. My dad was quite a jokester. Oh. I studied at the knee of my dad, who introduced me to all the great television comedians, Red Skelton, Jackie Gleason, all of the oldsters. And anyway, it gave me a very weird sense of humor. But every now and then, I hope that a little humor will make the point. Because to me, humor making a point is kind of a good thing. So we have about 10 minutes that we can spend with questions about meditation, about the four thoughts, I mean, the four noble truths, suffering, its cause, and so forth. We can talk about anything. In fact, if you want to ask about something off topic, I'm even willing to entertain that. Yes. 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 I have handouts, and I brought them this evening, but I don't have enough to go around. And so I'm going to make some more, and I'll hand them out first thing tomorrow. Because I need 2, 4, 6, 8. Okay, I need about double what I brought. Is anybody going to be here tomorrow? Anybody here tomorrow? Okay, then I'm bringing enough. Okay, that's good. I'm going to bring enough. I'm going to bring enough for everybody. But yes, in the drawing, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the drawing a couple different times. I won't just go through it once. I'm kind of into the repetition school, and I feel like being able to explain that pictorially is nice. But I also wanted to explain it in a sort of like a psycho-emotional way, which is why I'm talking about tonight about anger. Like, when you feel angry, sometimes, I don't mean you, when we feel angry, our body almost feels like it's on fire. We feel like this heat that's rising in our chest. And that gives birth to a really negative experience in us. When we're jealous of somebody, there's this like ache, you know, of wanting. And how that makes us feel. It makes us feel like we want to go to the mat and start fighting for what we think we deserve. And that creates another experience. When we are really attached to something, that makes us, you know, feel this like yearning for it. And this thinking that will, you know, make us really, really happy. And then that creates a world in which we live. And if we're stingy and miserly, then we never think we have enough of anything, and so we always feel deprived. And so then that's another type of experience. If we are obsessed with everything, then that's another type of experience. So these six types of experiences are experiences we go through, perhaps in a single day. We may go all the way around the wheel several times a day. Zim, 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 zim. You know, but it could also be that certain parts of it reverberate for us as a core negative mental affliction, negative mental habit that we're trying to work our way out of. And so talking about them pictorially sometimes helps. And so that's why I think that in the days before there were books, Buddhist books, the very first Buddhist teaching ever committed to paper, as it were, was this. Because there was a king who lived in Buddhist India who said, oh, someone has just given, another king from a neighboring kingdom has given me this really expensive, nice gift. What do I give him in return? And the Buddha said, get an artist in here and let me show him what to draw. And he had him draw this image, and he gave that. He said, now, King Bimbisara, give this to your friend. This is the best gift ever. So you could say it's the first Buddhist teaching, you could say that, committed to paper. And so it's because there weren't Buddhist teachings written down for 100 years after the Buddha died. There were no sutras until 100 years after the... I mean, they recited them, but they didn't write them down. Interesting, huh? So yes, we'll talk all about that tomorrow. And if anybody wants to take a picture home with them tonight without the explanation, sorry, I can definitely accommodate anybody who's not going to be here for the weekend. Other questions? Other questions that people might have? Okay, let's see. Who was first? Oh, okay, the gentleman and then the lady. Tim, I'm sorry, that's you. Yeah. Right. Right. Sure. You know, I wonder about that too sometimes. I really do wonder about that because I really am glad you asked this, because my first career, I was a journalist for 15 years, and I worked for a daily newspaper over in Newark, Ohio, and people would stop me on the streets and say, "Why do you tell only the bad things that happen? Why don't you talk about the good things?" And eventually I heard a psychologist answer that question better than I ever could. And she said the reason that the newspapers are filled with bad news is because people hurting each other is so abnormal. And it's so not what we want. You see what I'm saying? It's like we report the bad news because it's so unusual. Because the majority of people don't go around hurting each other in dangerous ways like you hear about on the news. And so it's odd, and because it's odd, they report it. But I also agree that it's nice to hear about the good things, too. I know. I'm getting there. See, this is a problem with me. I give long answers. A gentleman came to me once and said, you know, I need some help. I'm being troubled by some pretty bad demons. Can you get one of the Tibetan lamas to help me? And I talked to one of the Tibetan lamas, and he gave the young man some practices to do. But then, as a side remark, the lama said to me, "Why is it that we give so much power to the negative, and we don't at least give equal power to the positive?" So I think you're onto something. I think remembering and rejoicing in the good that you have done is a great thing, and that you should do that. In fact, there was a Buddhist teacher of the past who had, at the end of every day, he put two bowls in front of himself in a pile of stones. The one bowl was all of the negative things he had done. The other bowl was all the positive things he had done. And then he would add a stone for each negative thing he did and a stone for each positive thing he had done. And then he would see which bowl was the more full. And then he would rejoice in the good that he had done and regret the negatives that he had done and say, tomorrow I will do better. So I think that's a healthy way to look at it. I'm glad you brought that up. So, yes, it's fine. It's fine to think about that. I do think that human beings do tend to, I think it's because they fear bad things so much that they kind of keep it in sight. Kind of like the spider in the corner of the room. You don't want that thing to touch you, so you're kind of like watching it. So maybe we're more aware of these negative things. I hear that.
And I think we would feel more empowered if we
right.
more appreciative of all the good stuff.
Uh-huh. Which is why that monk had two bowls on his desk so that he could facilitate rejoicing. I think it's a good idea and we should all do it. So thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have it with me. I am teaching from this book, The 12 Links of Interdependent Origination by Trungpa Rinpoche. Yeah. And you can download it for free from the internet. This book is available, not with all the cool illustrations, so the cool illustrations are not in it, but in the internet version. Yeah, and you can go to Rinpoche, RINPOCHE.com. Yes, somebody took that one. Rinpoche.com. Or you can just type in the 12 links of interdependent origination, and then it will actually, the great God Google will give you, take you to this place. So your second question? I'm sorry? Because it's incredibly clear. It's super clear and super short. Because I only have like one weekend. You know, I only have one weekend. And you know, you see how long it takes me to even answer a simple question. I'm kind of hopeless without a succinct statement. And so I feel, and I've also received teachings on the 12 links from Kempo Carter Rinpoche. But I'm relying on the explanations here. So, yeah. Yes. I'm sorry, sure. The title, The 12, spelled out, Links of Interdependent Origination. No, I'm glad you asked. Okay. And it's Trungpa Rinpoche, and that's spelled Trangu. Yeah, it'll be the one on Rinpoche.com. Yeah.
I was just going to say, you can also see the picture on Wikipedia.
Right.
You have to type in 12 Nidanas.
Yeah, oh.
N-I-D-A-N-A-S.
Yeah, N-I-D-A-N-A-S, right.
Yeah. Probably look better on a large screen.
Yes, oh yeah, right. It'll probably look a lot better, yeah. You'll get to see more of it.
They got two. They got the one with the middle cut
out. Oh, yeah.
So you can see the 12.
Yeah. I have one suitable for coloring. No. Yeah, so that's we'll be talking about that. But the reason I brought up this reminds me of something, a point that I may not have completed. Everybody has a mind that has the potential to awaken. Everybody has a mind that has the potential to not awaken. And so the journey or the path of Buddhahood is to set aside the negative and embrace the positive, and then also to eventually tame the mind through the practice of meditation, and then train the mind to look at itself and experience itself directly. And this direct experience of itself then leads to Buddhahood and liberation from this wheel of becoming, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow. I just wanted to make sure I made that point. for the end of the... There's time for one more question, if there's one more out there. Well, you've been very patient. Thank you. And well, let's sit quietly for just a moment and mentally dedicate the goodness of this evening's session. We dedicate the goodness of this session to all beings who suffer. May they find the means to assuage their suffering, and may they find the means to liberate themselves from all suffering, and may they benefit all sentient beings. We'll mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, and thank you to the sound and video crew. Om mani padme hum.